After the war in Gaza in 2008-9, it was obvious for everyone that the Gaza province, the Gaza Strip, had been transformed into maybe the biggest open prison in the world, and a complete locked society where people were suffering. The Palestinians were very much suffering. And obviously, one had to do something for this. And then people all over the world, I would say, started to think that maybe, since we looked upon this way of blocking the whole Gaza Strip as illegal against, the most elementary civil laws in the world, then we thought maybe we should try to break that blocking of the whole Gaza Strip. And the only way to do it is with a convoy of ships. And so the idea was born. And when I heard about it a year ago, I thought this is a good idea. And I told someone who was in the organization committee that if I have the possibility, I will be prepared to join one of the boats. And this also specifically since I understood that the whole project was based upon humanitarian aid, one person, one country to another person and country. We should be completely free from all political organizations, direct political parties. Then immediately I got the question, how on earth are you supposed to guarantee that Hamas will not be involved in this? And I said, I can't guarantee anything. But what I can say is, what is the ambition? That's the first thing. And secondly, when it is fire in the house, you must get the water. You don't ask where the water comes from. You just get the help, get the water. And then you have to discuss if there was the wrong water, if you should have taken the water somewhere else. And this is also means if there would be the problems with Hamas, then you have to discuss that later.
So let me just interrupt and say, so you were on the ship and you're heading towards Gaza,
Yes.
and you were quite close to Gaza by that point.
No.
No.
This is the first very strange things that at midnight between Sunday and Monday, we still were very far away. I can't say directly how many sea miles, but it was a lot. So I decided this is possible for me to go and rest a little. Nothing will happen now. It was actually a little late. I think it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I hardly had fallen asleep until I was woken up, and they said, "Hey, they are attacking the big ship." And we could see her. We could see helicopters, and we could hear the shooting. And we asked, "What the hell is going on?" Because this is deep into international water. And what is this shooting about? And later I can tell you, I didn't get to know anything about what has happened until I was deported and on the Lufthansa flight to Europe. Then stewardess told me 10 people had died. I didn't know anything until then. Because naturally the Israelis had cut out all the possibilities to communicate. Now, anyhow, we realize, oh my God, the Israelis has chosen the real ugly solution to attack an international water. And we realize they will come for us sooner or later. Our idea was non-violent, non-fighting back, no nothing. And exactly 65 minutes later, at 4:35, we saw these black rubber boats come with the commando soldiers and with black masks. And we went up to the navigation place and we were standing there. We said, "Don't do anything." And they climbed the boat and they came up and they were very aggressive. Very, "Now you come down and you go quickly. Don't say anything. Come down." And there was an older man in the crew. He was maybe a little slow and they shot him with an electric gun, which is very painful. And he fell. He came up, and then there was another man that maybe also was a little slow, and they shot him with a rubber gun. It was very ugly, really. They brought us down. We had to sit down. And then they said, "Now we will search the ship." And they searched the ship. And then, and believe me, I tell you now, I have 24 witnesses to it. Then came one of these soldiers and said, "We have found weapon aboard this ship." And I said, someone said, "Can you see them, please?" "Yes." And then he held up a razor. You know, this one-time razor. And we didn't believe her. "Is that the weapon you found?" "Yes, and we also found a box cutter in the kitchen, you know, the cock head that were open, you know. So we have now found weapons aboard the ship, and this is completely legal what we do. Now we will bring you to Israel." And at that time I realized they had done, first of all, an act of piracy. Secondly, now they were doing a kidnapping of people. I really asked myself, what on earth are these people doing? This I will never understand as long as I live, because that kind of stupidity, I really don't understand. And you see the result of it. They got the whole world against it. So that was the first part of it. And then I can just say that we were forced to sit there on deck for 11 hours. We had some water, but no food. We had to ask if we want to go to the toilet, and it was rather ugly. And then we was brought to somewhere in Israel. I still don't know where it is. And they accused me of, I asked, what's the problem with you? What have I done? "Well, you have entered Israel illegally." I said, "Well, you must be crazy. It's you that brought me here." And they didn't want to discuss it. They said, "You will be deported." And so after another 30 hours, I was deported. And I was treated very, you know, no one was beating me or anything. But of course, they knew exactly who I was. And there was a specific man on my side to see that nothing happened to me, because they had problems enough. So, I mean, everything was, you know, the Israelis has made a stupidity out of themselves.
You even encountered one soldier who had read your book. So on the one hand, he was telling you what you had done illegally, but...
It was actually not a soldier. It was one of the men who was interrogating me. He was a little higher up. I don't know whether he was a policeman or a judge or something like that. He didn't have any uniform. And I asked if he could identify himself, and he just smiled and said, "No, I cannot." But he said that I read your books and I liked them, and okay. So maybe you can talk about that another time. Maybe you can talk about what you accuse me of, and, you know, nothing. But then we came to a very interesting situation, because he wanted to continue to talk about the books. And then I said, "Okay, fine. I'm going to give you my telephone number in Sweden. And you can call me if you ever go to Sweden. I promise to talk with you. But then you do something for me. You let me go now, because this is ridiculous." And because in that sense, I also said, I'm prepared to talk with anyone. I believe in dialogue, but not in this script that you are doing.
And how did he respond?
He took the telephone number. We'll see.
You'll wait and hear if
wait and see.
Contacts you. Some people could say there was an element of naivety about the whole mission, and there were some German politicians who came back and admitted they thought the whole thing was a little naive. Would you agree with that, or do you think that what has actually been achieved would actually override that?
I think it's very naive of people to say that this is naive. No, there was absolutely no naivety about this. We had a very clear strategy, we had a very, very clear plan. We realized very quickly what kind of problems we would face. And we knew from the beginning that probably, maybe, we will not get our stuff into Gaza. But we could anyhow win, depending on how the Israelis will react. We could get the focus on the situation. And look around. Israel has never been so criticized in the world as of today. Of course we won. So I think we were rather much more clever than the Israelis in the way of handling various scenarios of these things. So no, I would absolutely not say that we were naive. You'll see.
You're obviously known as the creator of the much-beloved Commissar Kurt Wallander. You're 62, you've sold millions of these books. You could now take it easy, you're just retiring Wallander. But instead you put yourself on the ship and in a very dangerous situation. What does that say about you? Is it something you feel you have a responsibility to do as a writer, as somebody who has a voice?
It's a part of my life. I have followed one ideology since I was 16, 17, 18 years of age. And that is, I believe so strongly in solidarity, the practical solidarity to change the world, as an instrument to change the world. And I believe in dialogue. But it's always, as you know, that it is the action that proves the word. It's never on the call. And we live in a world where a lot of people are talking a lot. I still remember a man in England called Tony Blair who spoke enormously a lot. But where were the workshop? So I believe in the workshop. And this is a part of my life. It is a part of me as a human being. It is a part of me as an artist. It's a part of who I am. To combine political work with artistical work. And I guess I will continue to do that as long as I live. It's my life and it is a privilege. And I can't see why in the hell should I retire from something that is important to do. I don't know what I should do. Everything is connected to the ideas to understand the world in which I happen to live a short while on this earth and try to make it maybe a little better. It's not more complicated than that. That's complicated enough.